From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. We're in the internet age, baby. David Letterman is leaving television. So are ads, the TV lifeblood. Big advertisers still spend billions on television, but the trend is now down. All over the place, digital, chasing you on Snapchat and Twitter. TV Land is trying new things to compete, trying to find advertisements that work on younger, more connected, more suspicious consumers. It's a challenge for this era's madmen and women of the advertising world. This hour On Point, as TV bleeds, where advertising is looking for you. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Can you still be sold by ads? Like what? Where? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Later this hour, we will look back at David Letterman's legacy as he wraps up a 33-year run tonight. But first, ads. Let us go back for just a moment to the very first episode of Mad Men, 2007. Here's Don Draper, played by John Hamm, explaining to a client what makes an ad campaign successful.
Advertising is based on one thing. Happiness. And you know what happiness is? Happiness is the smell of a new car. It's freedom from fear. It's a billboard on the side of the road that screams with reassurance that whatever you're doing, it's okay. You are okay.
And TV was glad to tell you so. Joining me now from New York is Suzanne Vranitza. She's advertising editor for the Wall Street Journal. She's been covering the advertising world for 15 years. Suzanne, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Also from New York, Ashley Rodriguez joins us, reporter for Advertising Age. Ashley, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Suzanne, so here we are. Last week, TV had its upfronts, rolling out its shows and selling advertising to them. You predicted going into the upfronts that sales would not be so great. I'm looking at charts here now showing for the first time, I think, negative growth, a decline in television advertising sales forecast for 2015. What's the situation, Suzanne?
Well, I think there's two sides of this coin. You know, TV has always reigned supreme, and from a financial standpoint, in terms of ad dollars, still does. But there's very little growth in this market anyway, you know, across the board. Mm-hmm. What we are seeing is we may not hit the negative territory. The upfront will be negative again this year, meaning the people that buy ads in advance. Mm-hmm. Overall, what we're expecting is national TV advertising revenue. For 2014, we saw it up 1%, and that even included the Olympics, which is a big advertising draw. It'll probably be up a little bit again this year. But from Wall Street's perspective and everybody else's perspective, we are now entering, especially the guys over at Bernstein, which is a big house that covers the TV companies. They expect now that basically we're entering this period of a structural decline. We're basically, and the reason for that is viewers are moving from an ad-supported platform, which is TV, to one that's online that's limited ad-supported, if not no ads. Think of what you, where you're watching content now, Netflix.
Mm-hmm. And you
so
just,
that's the issue.
You just don't deal with ads there. Ashley, what does that mean for advertising itself? Are people still into the Don Draper school of making dreams and, you know, sort of blowing all that beautiful smoke to get people over to buy whatever it may be? Or is it a different stripe of selling now? Is it about, I don't know, stats and data and profiling?
You know, I think it's a combination of those things. We're seeing marketers, you know, as, you know, to Suzanne's point, we're seeing a lot of marketers move a lot of their spending more towards digital and away from TV, or lessening their reliance on TV, but they still have these big television campaigns. You know, that's still important to them. It helps them reach a national audience. You know, take Old Navy, for example, which last year began lessening its reliance on TV. It still has a big campaign starring Julia Louis-Dreyfus and before that, Amy Poehler. But now it supplements that by releasing outtakes from that campaign online. So we're seeing more marketers finding ways to get more mileage out of their existing content by supporting it or finding other ways to use it across different platforms.
Suzanne, the business
has always decided that, you know, the death of TV has been called, in my career, numerous times. we definitely are seeing major changes. But the one thing that Mad Men showed us by that ending with the Coca-Cola ad, no matter what happens in advertising, the thing that that ending showed us is that advertising is still about connection and finding an emotional connection with the consumer. Now, the rise of digital has helped advertising accelerate, right? You can target me upside down, inside out. You know everything about me. But the one area that sometimes is lacking now is the fact that there's no creativity. So you can target me all you want, but unless you can bring emotion and something good to say, and that is often done with video, then you're really not going to change my opinion. And I think that we're at this sort of place in the ad business where everybody's struggling. Like, yes, you think the digital players are winning and the TV players are losing, but in fact, it's going to take both for a market to actually achieve it.
We don't want
to, you know. So I wouldn't say TV is really dead because, you know, there's not enough premium content online yet. Even though the growth of video online is huge, the content players are still not investing enough on premium content. And premium content is where advertisers still want to be because they want to be associated with things that uplift their brands, not anything that could be controversial or damaging. And that's still keeping TV, you know, as, you know, a $70 billion marketplace. So as much as they're in trouble, you know what? Still going to be fought hard for the digital guys to pull those dollars away.
I mean, it's ironic. I was with Ira Glass Monday night of the This American Life and More, no mean judge of these things. And Ira was saying, we've never been in a better era for TV when it comes to content. On the other hand, there's that tipping away from TV advertising that you talk about. Yes, the end of Mad Men. We won't give you a spoiler here exactly, but an old Coke ad plays a big role in the end of the whole long-running Mad Men series. And here's that Coca-Cola Hilltop ad, 1971.
I'd like to buy the world a home and furnish it with love. Grow apple trees and honeybees and snow white turtle doves. I'd like to teach the world to sing.
Sing with me.
Perfect harmony.
Perfect harmony.
I'd like to buy the world a Coke and keep it company.
There it was, 1971, a perfect rapture of peace and harmony and, of course, Coca-Cola. Ashley Rodriguez, does online advertising go for that emotional juggler?
I think it's heading in that direction. You know, initially when we had all of this data, marketers were still trying to figure out the best way to use it, and that came across a lot of the time in product ads. You know, I see what you're searching, so let me serve up some ads that I think are relevant to you as far as, you know, things that you might want to buy. But I think now it's more about trying to figure out the best way to, you know, create personalized, crafted, emotional messages that will get you to buy something rather than just wallpapering your screen with things that you already looked at and maybe decided not to buy already.
Or people running.
Think about the retargeting that's going on online. They know everything about you, so you shop for your shoes on Amazon, right?
And for the next
pair
month.
Of shoes.
Yeah.
Right. How is that a creative how does that actually sell more shoes? 9 times out of 10, it really doesn't. And so that's what we're finding, that, you know, while that has sustained the marketplace and got advertisers really interested because it worked to some level, what they realize now is, like, we need to have a creative solution and a more emotional solution that will get you to that next level. Like, okay, I don't need to see the shoes that I've already bought or that I really hated. So show me something different. It's the messaging, and I think we've gotten away from that in the last 5 years.
Online, whatever you show an interest in by your online behavior, yes, it can follow you around for weeks and months. Maybe this is it. Here's Taco Bell. They're known for experimenting with social media. They used the media app Periscope, video live streaming app owned by Twitter, to announce Breakfast Defector Day on May 5th. And here I am kind of carrying their water, but it's where this industry is. Here's their director of brand marketing, Amanda Clark, saying Taco Bell received a great response on social media. And the way she says that, which gets repeated, becomes a kind of advertising too.
We asked all of America to defect from their normal breakfast routine and come try the next generation of breakfast at Taco Bell. Well, we have gotten an awesome response. And I mean, some of you have even dubbed the biscuit taco a pillowy hug of breakfast deliciousness. Thank you. Thank you. So to thank all of our fans, we've created something that we're calling Breakfast Defector Day.
Okay, Suzanne, I mean, she may say pillowy hug of breakfast deliciousness, but my emotions are not being stoked right there. Am I just out of it?
Well, just think. First of all, we're probably not the target. But what's behind that campaign, because I know it well, is Taco Bell has done this amazing. So they use Periscope, and they're clearly after a younger generation. But if you follow that brand, whether it be on Twitter or any platform that they're on, they have a voice. They're talking to kids and their audience in a language that they like. What they're smart about doing for that company is they're doing it across every medium that's connected to them, every new place that these kids are tuning into, whether it's Snapchat, whether it's Tumblr, and they're using the new tools like you just explained. So as you're not seeing it, and if you see their TV ads, you're getting two different feels from the TV ad. It's a little insidery for those that actually know the new culture of the Taco Bell, but this also can be relevant to you. You might not fall for that one, but they don't expect you to be on Periscope. You're just a little bit ahead of your time. But for that company, it's all about making sure that they have a voice, and that voice can be a creative voice. And if you follow them on Twitter, you'll exactly know what I mean. So I think it's just smart. It's making sure that the message is across the different channels that are now available to them.
And of course,
yes, I agree. And while they're on all of these different channels, you know, it's not necessarily about being the first brand on there. It's about finding a really creative way for them to use that. So with Periscope, they created sort of a live newscast, if you will, where they launched this and, you know, people were able to connect. And I believe the actual announcement was towards the end of the newscast. You know, they did something similar with their Snapchat debut where they made a Snapchat movie and they leveraged the MTV Music Awards. So, you know, they're finding different and interesting ways to get into these platforms.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about TV, old-fashioned television, losing ads to digital, and what that means for both, for what you'll see, for how you're sold to. And we'll look a little later in this hour at David Letterman's Last Night, his Sayonara coming up tonight. Suzanne Vernitza is with us, advertising editor at the Wall Street Journal. Ashley Rodriguez is here with us, also from New York, reporter for Advertising Age. Yes, once upon a time, there was a kind of television hearth, and even ads were heard and seen and known by everybody. Here's Wendy's commercial, 1984, three old ladies inspecting a burger with a lot of bun, but not a lot of beef.
It certainly is a big bun.
It's a very big bun.
Big fluffy bun.
It's a very big fluffy bun.
Where's the beef?
Some hamburger places give you a lot less beef on a lot of bun.
That was then. This is now. They got to slip it in any way they can. 2012 episode of Hawaii Five-0, CBS. Talk about product placement. The New York Times called this one jarring, disruptive, insulting.
You own a shrimp truck, but you're bringing lunch to work.
Trying to eat smarter, brother.
Shrimp, perfectly healthy.
Not the way I make them. But this Subway sandwich, so ono.
Okay, so you're eating these to lose weight. Is that right?
It worked for Jared. And that boy was large.
Subway sandwich right in the middle of Hawaii 5-0. We're at 800-423-8255. Dot Lee writes us on Facebook, says, wouldn't know about TV ads. Haven't seen a TV ad in probably 3 years. 29er says, note to advertisers, no one's watching your expensive ads. TiVo allows us to fast forward. Adblock Plus keeps the web pages nice and clean. And Michael says, does Generation Z even watch TV? It's kind of a dated medium. What about that? Gen Z, not even there, Suzanne.
I think, look, if you had asked people 20 years ago, you would have got the same response. I don't watch ads. I don't like advertising. I hate ads. They don't work.
Yeah, but they didn't have half the ways of avoiding them that people have now.
They do. But if you look, if you go on YouTube, right, which is probably one of the biggest video platforms out there, and you look at some of their top videos of all times, guess what's up there? The top. In the top 10. The majority will be TV ads.
What?
No
People
joke.
Deliberately going to them, show me
yes.
an ad? Why? What takes them to that?
That's the sweet secret. People actually love advertising. They never want to admit it. I mean, mean they love good advertising. The problem that we find is that there's really a lot of bad advertising out there. And that's the issue. Because there's actually more advertising out there. That just means there's even more bad advertising out there. But the whole equation has always been, if your ad is good, people will watch it. They will talk about it. I mean, there's a story floating around today that, because YouTube's doing, I think it's YouTube, that's looking at like the top decade advertising. And if you go onto YouTube, there's, you know, they're all asking people to vote. Do you remember a couple years ago they had the Darth Vader ad, the little mini Darth Vader for Volkswagen?
Boy Vader,
That thing is still getting people to watch. Millions of people to go to YouTube and look it up and watch. And people are still sending it around. So I do agree that it's really harder to reach people because it's so fragmented. But the idea that people don't actually see ads anymore, I don't buy it. I think we just don't like to see bad ads. We like good ads. And the problem is the world has become an entire ad, right? Every platform has ads. And it's very hard to avoid them. So I think there's more negativity associated with ads. I mean, you can't pass. I mean, they're in the bathroom at this point. You can't escape it. And I think that's why people have such a negative reaction.
We're going to get a big ad man, madman on in just a moment here. David Droga. Let me get a call first. Miami, Florida. Matt's calling. Hi, Matt. You are on the air. What's your – what do you think, Matt?
Hi, everyone. Good to be on.
Yeah.
I'm currently studying advertising. And I'll tell you, digital is definitely where everything is going. That's pretty easy to say, a pretty safe bet. But the question is since we kind of talked about emotional advertising and how to connect to an audience, that with that option now, like on YouTube and this beta testing for Instagram and Snapchat, you can kind of skip all that. You can skip the advertisement if you don't want to see it. So how do you still connect to an audience within that, you know, 3 seconds you might get on that first impression?
Matt, I promise you we'll look at that. It's so funny. Has anybody ever told you, Matt, you sound a little bit like Pete Campbell on Mad Men?
Come to the job, I guess.
Matt, let me bring in a big expert to help us take that on. Stand by there in Miami, Matt. David Droga joins us right now from New York, founder, creative chairman of Droga 5. They won Best Ad of 2014 from Adweek for their Newcastle beer ad featuring actress Anna Kendrick. We've got Under Armour and Prudential and the Affordable Car Act and Motorola. David Droga, thank you so much for being with us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
There's a young student of your business who wants to know, in the next 5-10 years, as technology changes everything and people drift and life moves, how do you keep that emotional connection, if that's what you're gunning for, with potential customers? What's your advice to our young Matt in Miami, David?
Well, I think, you know, it is the era now where the onus has gone back to the genuine creative and strategic thinkers. I think the sort of the industry of built on the assumptions that people will see our advertising has gone, and that created a certain amount of laziness and formulaic advertising out there. I think the emotional connection is still very, very, if not more important than ever. And it's just because you can do something doesn't mean you should. I mean, technology is a great canvas for us, and as you said, you know, mobile, and people are putting ads everywhere. But I feel like the best stuff still does rise to the top, and it makes emotional connections by not just doing something that is emotive or funny or interesting. It's by understanding the context in which that will be consumed as well.
Is TV still the best canvas for creative advertising,
well,
David?
It's a wonderful canvas, but it's not seen in isolation anymore. I think, you know, when you want to do a mass play, again, if it's done well, it's fantastic, you know, because just the opportunity to tell storytelling there at a different level.
Mm-hmm.
But again, you know, it's also a place where there's a lot of money thrown to it and it doesn't work. I mean, I always start when I'm talking to any client or even to young students, I'm like, you have to understand that we're one of the only industries where people have invented technology to avoid what we create.
Yeah.
So if that doesn't force us
right.
to be better and think, let's create something that people want to engage in, is worthy of their attention, because it's a time play, right?
Yes.
We're asking people to give their time before they're going to watch something that they're going to or that they want to be there. And on TV and in print, and it used to be an acceptable toll. You knew that was part of the agreement.
Mm-hmm.
Now online, it's actually bad advertising is more intrusive, more offensive, because it's in this intimate space. And if someone's trying to flog something to you that's patronizing or just intrusive, that's why the advertising industry is sort of, people are thinking that this negative stuff. But, you know, the flip of that in running a creative agency, you know, it's a golden time for the industry as well, because it forces us and it forces brands to think about what's their role and what are they saying, and going back to that word context, like if I'm going to tell them a message, whether it be informational or humorous or entertaining, are they in the right frame of mind to want to hear our messaging, not just assume? So advertising is not going away in any shape or form. You know, obviously there's technology and data, but great advertising does rise to the top. And when we create television advertising, we never think, actually, we don't even call it television advertising. It may play on television, but we always go into the assumption that, is this something that people would want to forward? Is this something worthy of their attention?
So do you think about venue at all? Are you thinking, well, where's this going to be seen? Mobile, Snapchat or Vine or YouTube or...
100%. You have to think about it, because we're an industry that talks about storytelling.
Yep.
You know, that was the content. And then we sort of got obsessed with the canvas. What's the canvas? Is it television? Is it mobile? Is it out of home? And the context is the thing now we really have to think about. Like, at what time, where, are they open to receiving a message? And, is it just going to be the right message at the wrong time?
So
that could be a waste of money.
Here was the context. Super Bowl. You got a lot of attention for the ad you did with Anna Kendrick about Newcastle beer. We'll listen to it in just a second, but talk to us about how you thought about how to position and present this ad.
You know, being Super Bowl, a bit of an anomaly in the whole equation, because it's the one time that America sort of anticipates and is waiting to see what happens.
Super Bowl,
part of Newcastle. Bill, the campaign there was, the context of that was also, while people are familiar and look forward to the ads, they're also a little bit cynical about it, particularly in the beer category. Every ad kind of looks the same, smells the same, reads the same.
Yep.
And we thought, well, this scrappy little beer, Newcastle Brown Ale, you know, why can't we call BS on this whole thing and celebrate the fact that we can't actually afford a Super Bowl commercial? So really just talk about the commercial we wanted to make, and then we could have a lot of fun with that. And while the center point was the Super Bowl, it was much more the online chatter and getting people behind that and becoming advocates of this message we're getting out there. And it allowed us to put some sort of sharp edges on it. And fortunately, Anna Kendrick played ball perfectly, and she was so on point. And her whole message was about the disappointment of being called to do a big Super Bowl commercial, and then they, weren't allowed to do it. So all we ended up doing was showing storyboards for an outrageous commercial that we wanted to make, which was full of all the cliches, but just being able to poke fun at ourselves. And everyone was sort of on the inside of that. So you could create these ecosystems. I think that's the best thing now with advertising. If you can create these ecosystems where people's participation is baked into the process. And again, you can only assume they're going to participate if it's good. If it's trashy, that it's irrelevant and invisible.
I got to say, it sounds very Don Draper 2015 ad of the year from Droga5. And here's a little bit the premise: the canceled Super Bowl ad where actress Anna Kendrick talks about being booked by Newcastle Beer for a Super Bowl ad, then realizing that they don't have the money or permission to do it, can't even use the word Super Bowl.
I was really excited to make a commercial with Newcastle, but then turns out they don't even have the money or permission to make a commercial. They can't even say the word. It's bleeped. I don't even think they can say, like, game. I don't think you can mention football, like, in any capacity.
Beep, beep, bleep, bleep, bleep. Where did that even run, David? How did people see it? Where was it?
Well, that actually ran online pre the Super Bowl. And again, you've got to play with the tools you have. There's so much hype leading up to the Super Bowl. All these brands spend a fortune actually trying to tease out their commercials beforehand, like pretend that it slipped out, even though it's all very cynical and people do it on purpose.
Yeah.
And again, just knowing, so we were almost riding on the coattails.
But run it online. What does that mean? How did you do it?
Well,
where?
There are lots of homes where people sort of bury, from BuzzFeed and obviously YouTube and places like that, where it's sort of tagged within Super Bowl teaser commercials.
But then they have to come to you. The viewer has to come to you, in effect.
Well, that's exactly the point. I feel like that's the great thing, is earn their attention. You know, our starting point is, this is a bit blunt, but whatever we're producing, why would anyone care about what we're producing? Not why would we care, not why would the client care. Like, why would the target we're trying to talk to? And that works for comedy, or, we did some stuff for Under Armour with Misty Copeland. You know, again, you want to create stuff that is of interest to people and people can rally behind. And if it links to something that is interesting to them socially, and it sort of perpetuates what they believe in and what they stand for, and it's faithful and authentic to the client, that's when you've got something that has this extra potential and creates its own momentum. You know, because the Misty thing was about her, you know, doing her own thing and going against criticism. And that became not only great for Under Armour and authentic to who they are, but it's, again, it became championed by people became advocates of that. That became the, you know, more viewed online through people forwarding it and clicking it than they could have if they'd done a huge media buy.
You're clearly plugged in to something going on here. David Droga with Drogify, founder, creative chairman, best ad of 2014, says Adweek. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Sharon, Memphis, Tennessee. Sharon, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I absolutely agree with your guest today that advertising has to be entertaining. And if it's creative enough, everybody wants to watch it. Everybody looks forward to those Super Bowl bowl ads. And we will go to YouTube and watch E-Trade baby ads for entertainment. But recently, I actually didn't skip the ad. You know, on all those digital things like Words with Friends, or even when you go to the New York Times, you get an option to skip the ad in 5 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
And recently, I didn't skip the ad. It was for Raid Ant Spray, and it was so entertaining that I watched it. I had to confess that, yes, I didn't skip the ad, but if it's good enough, we'll watch it.
That's wild. Make it good enough that you'll watch an ad for Raid Ant Spray. Sharon, that's firsthand testimony. All right. Thank you. One more. Mike in Brant Lake, New York. Mike, you're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I guess I'm the contrarian in this conversation.
Okay.
I think of marketers and marketeers. And I've visualized in my mind's eye a plague of locusts trying to separate me from my money.
They want to.
And I, you know, I see entertaining ads, Super Bowl and all that, and I think, oh, they're clever, but they're not going to get my money.
Mike, you're the hard guy, not coming easy. One more. Bill in Nashville, you're on the air, Bill.
Hi, Tom. I'd like to talk a little bit about the relationship with the advertising industry and consumers. And in my perception, it seems the old relationship, especially with younger consumers, is kind of dying. And the way that advertisers are going to reach consumers in the future, I believe, is going to have to invite a more quid pro quo type of situation where young consumers actually gain something besides just entertainment from being engaged with advertising.
Like what?
So they get a bit. So they maybe get, you know, some kind of rebate or cash back benefit by participating in advertising campaigns in an interactive way, which is now, you know, much more capable than television ever was.
Pay me to watch you. Our time's short, Bill, but we've got it. Suzanne, what about it?
So for years, there's been companies that have had consumers watch ads to earn points. Let's just say the majority of those companies have went out of business. Some still exist.
Okay.
But the caller is right to some respects. There is now more of a value exchange. And let me explain what that means. They're not, you know, we're always going to get coupons. We're always going to get time off.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're going to get something off your product. Lots of ads do that. But the other thing that's happening is advertisers and brands have realized, like, there has to be a give and take relationship here if you're going to really build one. And a lot of times that's information. You're seeing lots of brands now get into this thing called content. It just means advertising, but what they're doing is they're giving you like something that you need. They're explaining something, and I'm making this example up.
Okay.
It's a diaper company. I'm going to send you an ad on your Facebook page and make it up. And it's an ad for a lovely little ad. It could have a video. But in that ad, it's going to give you 5 little tips to help keep your baby's bottom dry and
mm-hmm.
not to break out in rash. Like, what mm-hmm. if you do if there's diaper rash?
Yep.
They are definitely trying to come up with a value exchange. And here's the big, you know, elephant in the room. No one likes ads. But you know what? We all eventually won't be able to pay for all the media out there. And media companies, as well as that they're not ad-supported, many will end up having to be ad-supported at some point because they have to have a different revenue stream. And that's when advertising actually will not go away, because companies need revenue to survive. And there are different ways to get revenue. But having an ad-supported model, as well as a subscription model, helps companies thrive. So I don't believe that we're at the end of an advertising era. That's
maybe
for sure.
TV needs the money. So do others. Suzanne Vernitza with The Wall Street Journal. Ashley Rodriguez with Advertising Age. So great to have both of you today. thank you very much. We're going to think about David Letterman for a few minutes here. When we come back after a short break, I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Hi, everybody. Tom here. Glad you're joining us for the On Point podcast, sponsored by Audible.com. Many of the books featured on the show, like John Swed's Billie Holiday, The Musician, and The Myth, are available for you to listen to whenever and wherever you wish on Audible.com. It's like having your own personal library with over 180,000 titles that you can enjoy while driving, on the train, just about anywhere. As an incentive to get you to try this service, they're offering On Point listeners a free audiobook of your choice and a free 30-day trial. Just go to audible.com/onpoint, download a free title, and listen. It's that easy. Go to audible.com/onpoint. That's audible.com/onpoint, and you can get started today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. For more than 30 years, David Letterman was the anti-hero of late-night television, happily weird, ironic, often making guests uncomfortable. Passed over by NBC's Tonight Show for a sleeker, more mainstream Jay Leno, but also one of the funniest comedians around. He reinvented late night. Tonight is David Letterman's last show, and we want to think and hear from you about his legacy. We're at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Or join us at onpointradio.org or Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio on David Letterman. Here he was, 2007, interviewing then kind of hot celebrity Paris Hilton. And he bluntly asked her about her time. Well, you'll see. Here's Letterman Hilton.
Thank you so much for being here. How have you been? Are you all right?
Good to be back in New York.
Yeah, good to have you here. How much time do you spend in New York City? A lot?
Not as often as I'd like.
Mm-hmm. Which do you prefer, New York City or Los Angeles?
I like both. I like the weather in L.A. better, mm-hmm. but I love New York City.
New York City's exciting, though, isn't it?
I was born here, yeah.
Yeah, good for you. How'd you like being in jail?
Okay, how'd you like being in jail, Paris? Joining me now from Syracuse, New York, is Robert Thompson, professor and director of the University of Syracuse Center for Television and Popular Culture at the Newhouse School of Communication, author of Television's Second Golden Age, among others. Bob Thompson, welcome back to On Point.
Thank you. Boy, every time I hear one of these clips, I realize how much I'm going to miss this old guy.
What's going out the door when David Letterman goes out the door?
Well, I mean, he's already established his legacy, and his legacy is Conan and Fallon and Kimmel and all of the rest of them. I mean, practically everybody, with the exception of Jay Leno, started channeling David Letterman when they did their late-night shows. I mean, this was the guy that changed late-night television from the showbiz Johnny Carson sort of thing to the parody of Johnny Carson. And that's really what his show was. It wasn't so much a traditional late-night show as a burlesque of a late-night show. And it's now what everybody is doing. In fact, not only is it what everybody is doing, but everybody's doing it to the extent that it started making poor David's show seem a little tired toward the end.
Because it's a burlesque of it, you say. It's irony-laden. Did people know it at the time? Can you cast your mind all the way back those 33 years, people talking, what is this guy David Letterman and what's he doing?
Oh, man, I can remember. I had just started graduate school when he started his show on NBC. And, of course, it was on what at the time seemed like really, really late at night. This was a 12:30 show back then. And we watched that show every night, and our jaws dropped. We could not believe that someone was doing this on the mainstream medium of television, that what was happening on the screen was coming out of the same box that we saw Mr. Ed and The Flying Nun and I Dream of Jeannie from. And he did some really trippy Dada stuff back in the day. The episode where the image slowly rotates so that by the middle of the episode it's completely upside down, and by the end it's come back again to normal. Yeah. The episode where he gets two people to do color commentary throughout the show as though it were a Macy's Day Parade. This stuff is much more commonplace now, but when he was doing it, it was really really, to use a 60s phrase, blowing our minds.
Yeah. Here he was, 1987. Talk about Dada. Here's a segment in his NBC show, Late Night with David Letterman, in which he threw objects off of the top of buildings. Here's an episode, 87. He threw a barrel full of nails off a rooftop.
In this country, some people enjoy themselves by tossing horseshoes. In Greece, they toss the discus. In Scotland, they have the caber toss. Finland, interestingly enough, they have a keg of nail toss. So we're going to recreate that for you now.
Okay, there it is. Toss a barrel of nails.
That's even funny on radio, says something about David Letterman.
Sounds like a jet taking off there. Bob Thompson is with us. Anne's calling from Burlington, Vermont. Anne, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi. I love, I think he took over where David Dick Cavett left off, and I've always loved his wry wit. I always thought my dear friend Marion was nuts for staying up that late to watch, and then I got into it, and I'm still there.
Well, it was dry. I'll certainly grant you that. Who wouldn't, Anne? But did he really carry on from Cavett? I mean, Cavett carried on a kind of erudite conversation. Letterman blew up the conversation again and again, didn't he?
That's true, but there was always that undercurrent of intelligence. And I loved when Julia Roberts said to him the other night, "You don't like stupid people."
Yeah, and that would come across in a hurry. Bob Thompson, what about it? In the line of descent from Dick Cavett, really, Cavett would dive into some great issue of the day at great length. And yes, he was witty, and yes, he was dry. But Letterman seemed, did he really want to engage at that level?
Yeah, well, probably not. I mean, if I had to kind of trace his creative roots, first of all, obviously he was working off of Johnny Carson. So he was doing the parody of Johnny Carson. I already got into that.
Yep.
The other two, though, that I think don't get enough credit, because Letterman didn't come out of nowhere, were two people who had also hosted The Tonight Show, one only for a very brief period, but a guy named Ernie Kovacs, who was doing really, really hallucinogenic stuff way back in the late 50s and early 60s. He'd taken a brief stint at The Tonight Show, I think, as a summer replacement. The story goes that Letterman actually went to the Museum of Television and Radio and looked at some Kovacs before he started his show. Hmm. But the other one we have to give credit for is Steve Allen. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people alive today think of Steve Allen as a much more conventional kind of guy.
Yeah.
But Steve Allen, even before The Tonight Show started, was doing a late-night talk show on the NBC station in New York. And he did an entire episode from on top of a flagpole, which had a platform with a piano on it, yeah, that he would play, and at one point tossed hams on parachutes off to the people in the street. Letterman very much took that sensibility and took it for 33 years.
Take away the parachute, and maybe you've got David Letterman right there. Brent in Miami, Florida, you're on with Bob Thompson, thinking with us about David Letterman. Hi, Brent, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. It seems like Letterman's delivery is dry wit, and also he relies on vocal talking to kind of get across some of his jokes.
Mm-hmm.
I see that there's a trend going on that it's obvious through Conan, Colbert, and also Jimmy Fallon, that it seems a little bit more physical. I'm wondering if that new type of humor is going to become a common format within the Nightline circuit, and if that's indicative of the way millennials are consuming entertainment. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, more physical and maybe a little less dry. Let me play a couple of bits of tape back to back, and I'll pitch that to you, Bob Thompson. Here's Jimmy Fallon, 2014, still fairly new to his job, singing a parody of Born to Run with Bruce Springsteen called Governor Chris Christie's Traffic Jam. And of course, they're up there. They're in their sleeveless vest and red Springsteen headbands and aviators and all the rest. Jimmy Fallon.
Someday, Governor, I don't know when this will all end, but till then, you're killing the working man who's stuck in the Governor Chris Christie for Lee, New Jersey traffic jam.
There's a very physically up and singing muscle vest on Jimmy Fallon and Bruce Springsteen. Let's compare that. Of course, different time, but even so, 1982, very first episode of David Letterman's show. He had Bill Murray on as his first guest. And on Tuesday, he popped out of a cake for Dave's second to last show. But here it was, 87.
What are you playing with there?
It's just lint. It's just lint. Come in inside my pocket. Here, I got more.
Now, this is interesting. You were in a movie last year that was number 5 in the box office tabulations.
That was number 3.
Number 3. You're a major star, and yet here you are playing with lint balls.
1982, very first show. All right, Bob Thompson, there's Jimmy Fallon singing Born to Run in a muscle shirt versus David Letterman talking with Bill Murray about lint balls.
Well, and I guess maybe those two clips tell you pretty much all you need to know. Now, it's not that Letterman couldn't be physical. He dressed up in a Velcro suit and jumped onto a Velcro wall.
Yeah.
He dressed up in an Alka-Seltzer suit and jumped into a vat of water, I guess. So he did physical kinds of things, but lint was probably more. I mean, after all, this is a guy that named his company Worldwide Pants.
Yeah.
Whereas Fallon is much more of this hail fellow. And he tries to appeal to both grandma and the college kids. But Fallon has also got a sense, of self-love that we never saw with David Letterman.
Yes.
Fallon gets Barbara Streisand to come on to a TV show for the first time in forever. And what does he do? He has to sing a duet with her.
Yeah.
If Fallon could resurrect the two dead Beatles and bring them all together, Fallon would be the fifth Beatle. Letterman was not like that. Letterman was a much more... it seemed less self-absorbed and more self-loathing, and
yeah.
That became part of his character, especially in the later years.
I mean, he would beat up a David Letterman dummy on stage if that's what it took.
And you know what's so interesting? That second-to-last episode that played, remember when Bette Midler on the second-to-last episode of Carson, she sang that beautiful song to Johnny, and we got to see Johnny getting all choked up.
Yep.
When Dylan sung that equally beautiful song and equally appropriate song on Letterman, clearly everybody was directed, do not show a shot of Letterman. That whole song went,
mm-hmm.
and it was all on Dylan, and it never went to Letterman, and we wanted to see him getting choked up, but he wouldn't let that happen.
To me, that's a pretty big change, this turn of the wheel here. Jimmy Fallon's kind of, to my eye, and a more mushy, gushy, self-love, not a bad word for it. And to me, it seems an older style, back to, you know, Buck and Wing really putting on a show, hosting.
That you hit the nail right on the head. Fallon has really got a sense of vaudeville. It's like Mickey Rooney and Judy Garland, just as you said, let's put on a show. And it works for the biggest audience. Who's in first place in late night television? It's Fallon. In many ways, what Letterman did was something that it was a more art house kind of approach to things, and it got a pretty big audience in its day. But in the end, if you want to be number one, you're right. You put on a show, you do a little tap dance, and you do some stuff that people will watch on the internet the next day.
The anti-hero fans will have to go a little bit elsewhere. Carol in Nashville, Tennessee. Carol, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Tom, thanks so much for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I've got to say, I had one of the most interesting jobs in the world in college at our college radio station, WBS-CFM, where I was the music director, and David Letterman was one of our on-air personalities.
Fantastic. Where was that, WBS-CFM? Where?
Ball State University.
Fantastic. And there was Letterman. How was he to work with in college?
He was... pretty much as you see him on TV. He's kind of a tough guy. He doesn't really want to take direction. He wants to go his own way. But I would say to the kids on campus, I said, you have got to listen to this guy. He is so good. He is so funny.
Was he that acerbic, rebel, standoffish
yes.
guy we see
yes.
even now?
He was all of the above. He was a pretty cool, as in temperature, character.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he has kept that through the years. You know, it's hard for him to warm up, but that being said, his talent was just tremendous, and, you know, we were all in radio together, but Dave more so, and we had Dr. Weibel and Dr. Tomlinson for courses, and it was just wonderful.
Carol and Dave at Ball State in Indiana all those years ago with the Indiana boy, David Letterman. Wow, firsthand account of early days. I love that, Carol. Thank you very much for that. One more, George in Miami. George, you're on.
Thank you very much for taking my call, Tom.
Yes.
Tom, I don't want to get too emotional, but I tell you, watching the last few shows of Letterman, I cry like a baby.
George, David Letterman would not go for that. Now, you've got to be dry-eyed, George.
I know that. But the thing that most TV commentators should learn from Letterman is that he came out so sincere, so true, like if you knew the guy, if like yeah. you were talking to him every night. That is the thing about Letterman. His beliefs, his political inkling, all of them came out completely, and it was obviously that most actors and actresses liked him, really liked him. Most people really liked him for what he was. So, well, now I'm talking like if he was dying, but he is dying with me. You know that Letterman is the only show that I watch on TV religiously, every day.
George, I appreciate your call so much. How do you square that, Bob Thompson? Letterman's famous bite or almost bitterness with that kind of love from George right there.
First of all, I think George should be invited to be on the final episode.
Me
that
too.
Would be a nice touch. But I think he's absolutely right. There was a sense that you have this guy who is both known for being cold and standoffish and maybe even a little misanthropic. But when he was on camera, you got the sense that, as Flip Wilson used to say, what you see is what you get. There was a sense of sincerity that in all his acerbicness, he wasn't covering up the fact that, this was who he was. And I agree, the last couple of episodes where he's really shown a much more softer side have been very kind of emotionally draining, and I wouldn't be a bit surprised if in the final episode we actually finally see David Letterman in, dare I even predict, maybe even a weepy moment.
Oh boy, the universe may split in half.
Who's
the heir, Bob Thompson? Where can George go when David Letterman finally, you know, heads off in those fancy shoes of his?
Well, I think Kimmel is probably the purest heir to David Letterman. Of course, Kimmel was playing David Letterman Dollhouse when he was 6 years old. Kimmel wanted to be David Letterman from the time he was conscious. And I think he's doing the most David Letterman-esque kind of thing. Whatever we see from Colbert is going to be a very, very different kind of program. I have some concerns as to whether Colbert is ever going to be able to escape the gravitational pull of that character he played on Comedy Central. But there's a lot of good stuff happening on Late Night. None of it is exactly what David Letterman was. But then again, for the last several years, David Letterman wasn't exactly what David Letterman was.
Robert Thompson, you always deliver, and it's fun to retrospectively have kind of listened and watched for all those years with you. Thanks so much for being with us on David Letterman's last day on air, Bob. Thanks for joining us.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.
Bob Thompson at Syracuse University. And yes, it's going to be fascinating to see what Colbert does with that, who Colbert will be. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.